At my monthly Ask Me Anything webinars, I always get questions about hormone therapy. When to start, when to stop, if the dose should be changed as women get older, what to do if someone keeps flashing or bleeding, how to know if you're getting enough to protect your bones. So it was fortuitous that at the last annual meeting of the Menopause Society, Dr. Risa Kagan gave a lecture on the what-ifs of hormone therapy. Basically, what to do if things are not going according to plan. So today, Dr. Kagan and I continue the discussion, including the questions I get most frequently about starting, stopping, and switching hormone therapy. I'm Dr. Lauren Stryker, a gynecologist, best-selling author, and a nationally recognized menopause expert. When it comes to menopause midlife and what comes after, I'm betting you've not gotten a lot of information from your own doctor. If women are given good information, they'll make good choices. And I'm here to give you the inside information. Today's guest, Dr. Risa Kagan, is on my personal list of menopause experts who I go to when I have a question. She's a clinical professor in the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology and Reproductive Sciences at the University of California, San Francisco. She's been invited to speak at hundreds of medical conferences and is an extraordinary teacher. Dr. Kagan has published too many scientific papers to count in medical journals on pretty much every aspect of menopause, which is why she has been a frequent guest. And if you haven't listened to her other episodes, I'll include links to them in the program notes. Before we dive into specific questions, could you just start by, just really quickly, review the indications for starting hormone therapy? Because right now there's a lot of confusion about who should even consider taking it.
There's a lot of confusion and misinformation, as you know, in the wild, wild west of menopause is having its moment, and so is hormone therapy. You know, the indications for menopausal hormone therapy are for sure the hallmark of menopause, hot flashes. And people always say to me, do they have to be moderate to severe? But when we do clinical research, you know, we have to do moderate to severe and count 50, you know, 7 a day, 50 a week, drenching, sweating, hot flashes, the worst, because you have to prove that over the placebo response, which is often anywhere from, you know, 40%, sometimes even higher, 50 to 55%, but, you know, 30 to 40%. But they work for mild hot flashes too. But hot flashes, okay, the prevention of bone loss and the prevention of osteoporosis, it doesn't have the actual indication for treatment, although some of us do use that in younger women who have never fractured. And the reason for that is there hasn't been a large, huge, gold standard randomized controlled trial like we do in the bone world with women with osteoporosis and fractures and showing that efficacy of reduction. But we know from many, many studies that it can help reduce fractures, preserve bone mass, and prevent osteoporosis, and even treat people who are not super high risk with fractures and preventing fractures. Okay, so VMS, hot flashes, bone health, and then it also has the indication for treating vulvovaginal atrophy, which is the official term, but we try to call it genitourinary syndrome of menopause because that's part of genitourinary syndrome of menopause. Yeah.
And I think it's also worth pointing out that if someone's only issue is genitourinary syndrome menopause, then we would usually go to the local estrogens. But if someone is taking systemic estrogen for bone health and hot flashes, it's nice to know that what I usually quote about 70% of women are also going to have adequate treatment of their vulvar and vaginal.
Although I do, symptoms. I mean, I do tell women though, try, if we're using standard dose, or we'll get into all of that, you know, absolutely let's wait and see. You still need your lubricants and moisturizers, but the lower doses, the last place to get it is the vagina.
That's a long way to travel, you know? Absolutely.
So I always say, if you're really going to be using lower doses, which many women and as women age do, then we usually have to add local vaginal products, whether it be estrogen or even vaginal DHEA.
Right. Okay. But so for the purposes of this discussion, for the most part, let's stick to just systemic therapy because it's really where we get the most questions. And so you've already established that you don't have to have these, you know, horrible all day, all night, terrible, terrible flashes to start hormone therapy. But the other thing that comes up a lot is so many women are either told or under the misconception that they have to wait a full 12 months without a period before they can start hormone therapy. So how do you approach that in terms of
at what point
someone can start?
Well, I mean, we know now from these big studies, and you've talked with other people about the study of women across the nation, the Penn Ovarian Aging Study, their longitudinal studies, the women start suffering before the final menstrual period. So when we do clinical research, we say you can only be in the study if it's 12 months of no periods, we call it amenorrhea, or 6 months with an FSH over 40. I would say that most of us do think that menopausal hormone therapy is definitely valuable and easier to manage if you're in the late perimenopause, okay? And if you're in the late perimenopause, what's that definition? You know, you're skipping 3 months, 6 months. You clearly have been going through this for a while. It's not just having regular cycles with hot flashes or even cycles every, you know, irregular cycles with hot flashes. As you know, and you've been on here with many of my colleagues talking about the treatment of the perimenopausal woman, without contraindication, women in the early perimenopause do much better by what they call suppressing and substituting with a continuous hormonal, they call it hormonal contraceptives. Yeah. I wish we would.
But we don't. We call it perimenopausal hormone therapy.
Right. We should call it perimenopausal hormone therapy. Right.
But, you know, and of course, that's because, as we've often talked about, it's not just that your hormone levels and your estrogen levels are dropping. It's that they're the roller coaster. They're up, they're down, they're right. surging. And that's why you need to suppress in order to get them under control. All right. But to that point, another question that came in was, if someone is taking appropriately a low dose continuous birth control pill to manage perimenopause, and they're now, you know, thinking about switching over. Number one, at what age do you stop the pill and start hormone therapy? And number two, can you go right from one to the other? Or do you tell your patients, let's take you off the pill, see what's happening, and then consider starting hormone therapy?
Well, this is obviously choice and the usual shared decision-making, the buzzword, okay? But patients want our advice, okay? So it really, I mean, women can stop and see. I've had women do that, go a month or two. You can't just stop for 2 weeks, check a hormone level and say, oh yeah, you're there. Because you know as well as I know that changes, all right?
Right.
But most women, I do encourage, once we have a discussion, if they're going to continue on something, to just go from their birth control pill or their ring or their whatever, they can definitely just go right on to hormone therapy.
And at what age do you tell them to do that in general?
Let's get right there, okay? And every society, including the old CDC, which we could always rely on, will endorse that women, number one, need contraception. And so we have to find out if they need contraception, okay? But here's reality. The average age of menopause, the median, okay, is 51 to 52. You know what that means? That's only 50% of women are really there. That means there's a whole 50% of women that still need birth control that really are still cycling if you try to change at that age. So we've learned that by 55, this is assuming you see the woman every year and they're healthy, they don't have any major medical contraindications to staying on that continuous oral contraceptive pill or whatever the ring, which is very easy continuously, 90% of women by 55 are menopausal. So that is really where that 55 comes from. Yeah. So I usually tell women, don't try to change till you're around mid-50s and then you'll sail on through and then we change. I have done that with women. And then a month or two or three later, she's calling up saying, I'm having full-blown periods on my combined continuous hormone therapy with symptoms of PMS. And I go, okay, you're not done yet. We need to go back on something.
Right. Someone's got to be on the other side of that bell-shaped curve.
Yes.
Okay. But so here's my question, because I do the same thing. I say, you know, continue until you're 55 and then we'll transition you over. But for the woman who's say 49 or 50, and wants to just go off her pill for whatever reasons and wants to know if she is in fact already post-menopause, because since she's been on the pill for, you know, years, she may not know that. How long do you tell her to stay off her pill to either then decide to start hormone therapy or check levels?
you know, checking levels is controversial at that time. Yeah. So at least a month. I mean, there was a time where people thought, oh, you could go 7 days and then check. But then when they really looked at it, it's not reliable to check an FSH level, the level of the hormone in the brain that goes up high. So I think that if they wanted to really see, I mean, a lot of it is, you know, in a month, should they use birth control? Well, we'll check that FSH. I mean, if you have an FSH that's 60, 70, 80, you know, but if you have one that then, you know, something over that year was very low, that they are definitely menopausal. But if you have somebody who's like 20, 25, 30, this like middle range, you know, perimenopausal, they might still ovulate. They might, listen, I have seen women in their 50s get pregnant. Let me just tell you that.
And not to mention,
they miscarry.
Sometimes that elevation in FSH is an indication of ovulation. We forget that, you know, that ovulation in your FSH goes up.
Right.
So you can get fooled.
Usually, honestly, if somebody at 49 or 50 wants to stop and they don't want to go right on something, then I say, okay, let's wait and see what your symptoms are like. Let's see what your cycles are like. Let's see if you're having cycles. They usually come back in within 3 months with some kind of complaint.
Yeah. And I'm with you. In general, for most women, I think the greater good is stay on it until you're 55, if you're, you know, a good candidate and you're low risk, and then switch over. And a lot of people will say, well, how am I going to know if I'm postmenopause? And my answer always is, you're not. Isn't that a beautiful thing?
You know what? Staying on till 55 eliminates that roller coaster. Mm-hmm. And that roller coaster is really wreaks havoc for many, many women. And actually, some women are much better when the storm is over and then it's the calm, and you can give combined continuous menopausal hormone therapy in a very effective way.
Yeah. All right. Let's move on to a different scenario. So this is a woman who has, you know, hasn't had a period for a couple of years, and she is just dying with her hot flashes. And they're all day, all night. And she has a long planned trip to Italy. And she's leaving in a couple of weeks. And she has decided, okay, I'm not going to be miserable during this trip. And I'm going to start hormone therapy tomorrow. So she wants to know, how long is it going to take her to get some relief?
Well, usually when somebody takes, if she's that miserable, first of all, there's different doses. If you start really low, I tell them you got to be patient. It's going to take much longer. So I would give that person at least what we call standard dose hormone therapy. And we do have equivalents for what's called standard dose based on clinical trials and research and what works in reducing those moderate to severe hot flashes. And for sure, we have efficacy as soon as 2 weeks. People will notice something, whether it be the less severity or the less frequency. They'll still have some. And you have a marking point at 4 weeks. Full efficacy is usually 3 months.
Okay, so she's desperate to feel better in 2 weeks when she's taking her trip. What's the downside? What's the downside of starting her at a higher dose? Because even a high dose of menopausal hormone therapy is not very much estrogen. So why not just try and blast her?
I mean, I would still do standard dose, because the majority of women have very good relief with standard dose hormone therapy. I'm not sure that higher is going to make it, you know, that much better than standard dose.
Well, it's not going to make it any quicker. I think
quicker.
Right. It's not going to make it better. Okay, but the other thing also is she's saying, you know, so look, am I going to get 100% relief? And how many women at standard doses do get 100% relief? I mean, let's talk about managing expectations, because a lot of people think that they're going to get 100%.
I think that at standard dose hormone therapy, there's no question that I can give them 99 to 100% relief of the severity. And that's where we're talking about women are sweating, women are having to stop what they're doing. They might still have some mild hot flashes. You know, there's this definition of mild, moderate, and severe.
Yeah.
And, you know, so I think the mild internal flash, the moderate where you're sweating, but no one, you know, you can see the person sweating, but they're still talking. And severe is where they have to stop what they're doing. Because I think we can, with standard dose, get rid of severity for sure, 90%, if not more. I think when it comes to the other, you want to know with nothing's 100%, you know, 90%, let's use that word. What do you say to people?
Well, if you look at the clinical trials and if you ask, you know, what can you expect with hormone therapy? I think they're really only saying you're going to get like 70% relief overall, but certainly clinically, like you.
No,
It's a whole lot better than
that. You know why?
I'm not afraid to go higher.
Well, no, because it depends on the dose. And I think that most would say with higher doses, which are not high, we can achieve at least a 90% response.
I think that's really the key, is that so many doctors, quite frankly, and patients get nervous. And they're like, okay, well, I'd rather use a much lower dose.
We're not getting into this today, but there's no alternative that is as good as estrogen.
But we're not even talking about the neurokinin inhibitors, which are the non-hormonal options that are FDA approved for hot flashes. But even those are quoting about what, in the like 65, 68%?
Well, basically what I say, what I tell people is at a month, they start rapidly. That's for sure. You see some reduction, but at 4 weeks, it's a little over 50%. Like, and it's 12 weeks when it's full efficacy, they're over 60%.
Yeah.
But again, Lauren, a lot of women will take a few hot flashes if they're not sweating and being, woken up by the drenching sweats and the hot. So the mild hot flashes for some women are quite tolerable, but it's this moderate to severe where really wreaks havoc on people's lives.
And, I think that's such an important point because there's really two things we're looking at. One is the number of hot flashes that someone has, and the other is the severity. And it's not the same thing. And I think even if someone's still left with a few hot flashes, like you said, people are willing to deal with the mild hot flashes.
Right.
Absolutely. All right. So a woman wrote in that she's been using one of the higher dose patches, a 0.75 milligram estradiol patch, but she continues to have severe hot flashes. So she asked her doctor to check her blood level, and it was 10. And her doctor is reluctant to increase her dose anymore. So if she was your patient, what would you tell her?
Well, I would really, first of all, try to find out, what patch she's on, where she's placing it. Is it falling off? She may not even realize it. 10 is like very, that's like a postmenopausal woman on nothing. So I think that I rarely check levels. The only indication, if someone's doing well, I wouldn't go checking levels.
Of course not. Yeah.
But if somebody's having symptoms like this, then I say there's got to be something going on here that's not right. And that's not a good level. That's not an adequate level. So, clearly I have to ask all these questions about where she's placing it. When was the blood test done in relationship to placing a new patch? All of that. I would have no problem going up on it, but I'd want to change something in trying to figure out if this is a lab error. I tell you another thing. I just say, okay, let's then try a gel.
Right.
I'd switch to something else and see what's going on with that. Or even a pill. I have to just say, because we just talked about contraceptives and changing at 55 years of old, I really want to make one statement here. There are healthy, healthy women that have no reason not to use an oral form of estradiol or conjugated estrogens called Premarin, okay, in their 50 to 60 years of age. I mean, one day they're on a birth control pill and the next day they have to be on a patch. I mean, for healthy people, transdermal delivery, there is no question. It bypasses oral absorption going through the liver. It definitely, an observational study shows a decreased risk for, blood clots and stroke, et cetera. When you are getting, that's an age-dependent factor or high-risk other medical comorbidities, okay? So if you smoke, yes, you should be on transdermal. You have hypertension, yes, you should be on transdermal. You have other medical conditions, obesity, yes, I think transdermal. But if you were a healthy woman who had been on a birth control pill until 55, and the next day she's being on hormone therapy, she doesn't have to be on a transdermal at that point. Right. All right. Maybe when she's 60 and we're even longer, which we're going to get into, for sure, transdermal. So I have, don't bash the combination pills. They're easy to take. Some of them have great amenorrhea, no bleeding profile. Some of these, are really work better for women.
Yeah, absolutely. And I always tell people that's a red flag. If you have a doctor that really only has one form of hormone therapy, puts everyone on a patch and says the patch is the best, take the patch. That kind of tells you that person probably isn't an expert. It's like going to a cardiologist who gives everyone the same antihypertensive pill.
Exactly.
It has to be individualized. And I'm in agreement with you. The one thing I would not do is say, let's slap on a second patch or let's do more patches, because that's what a lot of people think they should do.
Right.
And like you, I would switch to a different transdermal just to see if she wants,
Do you know that different patches, there's different generics. People don't know this out there. I tell them, bring the boxes. Let me see the box. Look at the box. The box may have a different manufacturer. There's Sandoz and Mylan, and then somebody gets a Dottie. It all says estradiol 0.75, right? 0.75. Right. So you have to really look and see if there's been a switch or a change.
That's right. And then also some of these patches are matrix patches and some of them are reservoir patches, which for people who decide to cut their patches in half, you know, we're not even going to get into that right now, but they could get into big trouble.
I think they've gotten away from using the older, if you have a Band-Aid patch out there, somebody get rid of it.
Get rid of it. It's probably too old. Right, right. But no question that for some people, just switching to a different transdermal option may do it. And don't be afraid of oral because, as you said, for a lot of people, that's their best bet.
Right.
And to the point that you were making, because you kind of threw out there, you mentioned about how some protocols cause more bleeding than others. And that was actually a different question that came in. This woman who said, I've been on four different protocols and I keep having this nuisance breakthrough bleeding. And you know, she goes on to tell me that she had all the right stuff. Her doctor did an ultrasound and a biopsy and it was all normal. There was no buildup. Everything looked great, except she was just sick and tired of the bleeding, even though her doctor reassured her that she was just one of those people that spots on hormone therapy. So you mentioned that some protocols are better than others to minimize the chances of breakthrough bleeding. So tell us about that.
Well, first I want to know if people come in all the time with their ultrasound and their biopsy report, but honestly, they need a directed visualization. We need to know that they've had a hysteroscopy. And it could be done in the office. It can be done in the outpatient department. If they've had a hysteroscopy,
meaning taking a scope and looking inside the uterus to make sure there's not a polyp or something else going on.
Make sure there's no polyp, something else. Okay, so then one of the best things that person could do is be offered an levonorgestrel IUD. Mirena is the common brand name, because we know that has really good efficacy where you're putting local progestogen in the uterus and then you only have to take a pill or a patch. And that has a very good amenorrhea profile is the word. Yeah. No bleeding.
Hey, you don't need tampons anymore. It's the non-medical word for it.
No bleeding or spotting. There are some other combination. There are other regimens that are really good. I mean, sometimes micronized progesterone, which is that bioidentical natural progesterone, isn't the best for some women as far as combining continuous, not ever bleeding or spotting. So then I say, okay, if you really want to stay on that, let's try a cyclic regimen. And a cyclic regimen is where the person would be on some estrogen continuously, but they might take 12 or 14 days of this progesterone. And then if they're going to bleed, they would have a bleed, hopefully very light, right at the end of that.
So she doesn't want to do that. She wants to wear her, you know, new white pants and throw out her tampons.
Okay, fine. So then we have a few other products. There's no real good head-to-head, but there are some combination products that seem to have better profiles than others if you look at them individually. Somebody might try the Combi Patch. The Combi Patch is a combination of a 0.05 estradiol with a synthetic progestin, norethindrone, which actually works pretty well on the endometrium twice a week. You have to try different things. Of course.
I'm actually kind of interrupt you for a second because I'm kind of surprised to hear you say that because I've always found in clinical practice, if anything, that was one of the protocols that I'd see the most breakthrough bleeding is using a Combi patch.
That's not what you found? No, not personally. And when I look at their amenorrhea, I mean, there might be spotting periodically, but for the most part, many people, the effect of a norethindrone on the endometrium appears to be really inducing a lot more amenorrhea. There's also, I will tell you, there's a combination pill that has a beautiful sustained release, continuous, at the end of the year, it really looked like placebo with bleeding, okay? And that is called Bijuva. And that is a combination of estradiol with micronized progesterone in a capsule where there's very good efficacy for hot flashes and safety with, you know, endometrium lining of the uterus. And that, by the end of the year, they had a, you know, really over 90%, just like the placebo. Because, you know, even a placebo has some spotting and bleeding, as you know. And then, of course, my favorite, as you are alluding to, is the combination, the DuaVe product, which I've talked about with you before, which is a combination of the conjugated estrogen Premarin for the hot flashes or preserve. And then you combine it with an anti-estrogen called basodoxifene, which is a whole no progestin at all. And that has the ultimate incredible side effect of no bleeding.
No bleeding. I thought that's where you were going to go first.
I know. I didn't go actually, first there.
We did a whole podcast on that. So I'm going to put the link in the program notes so people can go back and take a listen, because we really kind of walked through why the bleeding profile is so good and the other advantages of that. The other thing I just want to throw out there is you mentioned about using a Mirena IUD, a levonorgestrel IUD. And don't forget that if someone does need to have a hysteroscopy to take a look inside, that's the ideal time to put the
Absolutely.
IUD in. Because, you know, if you're worried you have a polyp or something, and if your clinician looks inside your uterus and says, nope, clean as a whistle, looks great, no polyps, everything is fine, she's just having nuisance bleeding, while you're there under maybe a little anesthesia and your cervix is dilated, is the ideal time to throw that IUD in.
That's why I mentioned that first, because I probably would do that first, and I would encourage, you know. Mm-hmm.
And I do have a Substack, I'll put that link in the notes as well, about questions about using a progestogen IUD for uterine protection in menopause, because there's always a lot of questions. And there was a nice article on it in the Menopause Society Practice Pearls. So I used that article and kind of walk through all the questions people have. So I will put
It was an excellent
out there. Yeah, because there's always a lot of questions about that. Okay, on to the next. This is, I'm going to give you a few different scenarios of the same question. Okay. So a woman is told, because this happens all the time, she's on her hormone therapy, she's doing great. She goes to see her internist who says, it's been 5 years, it's time to go off. And I think the first thing that you and I would say is, well, it kind of depends on why she's taking her hormone therapy. So what I want to do is,
the first thing I'd say is, why the 5 years? Where did that?
Well, of course, that's right. There's no science. There's no data that supports that at all. But I think, forget the 5 years. Let's just talk about if someone is thinking about staying on their hormone therapy longer term, you know, we're going to say, why, you know, what's your goal? Why do you want to? So let's walk through.
We walk through with the woman. Why did she go on in the first place? What are her personal goals? What are her long, you know, where is she at right now in her life and her health history? Does she have any changes in her personal health? Is she doing it just for hot flashes, or is she really doing it because her mother?
All right, so let's do that. Scenario number one.
Right.
She went on it primarily because of hot flashes. Okay. It's now been 5 years, and she wants to know, how likely is it if she goes off that she's still going to be having hot flashes? So let's say she's about 55 years old.
Right. Well, first of all, I would never tell her to stop at 55 years old, Lauren, because we know from SWAN that the median duration of hot flashes is 7.2 years. And that means that people are hot flashing or can for 14 years. So I tell people they probably are going to need to be on it longer than 5 years. But, you know, for some, maybe 5 years. All right. So when you stop, the data is quite mixed in the literature, but there are some very good large studies showing that when women go off of hormone therapy, I used to quote a 50%, and that was an older study that was published in like the 2000s early, about 50% of women went back on something, sometimes lower doses, okay, or different delivery systems, but they needed something. And it was either for hot flashes, sleep, mood, just basically didn't feel well, okay? And more recently, 2 years ago, there was a published study in our journal that surveyed this large population of women, and they even said it was up to 90%. So I think I always say 50 to 90% of women will want to consider going back on something for some reason. And usually it's hot flashes.
Okay. Let's switch that up a little bit. Let's say that she's not 55. Let's say that she's past that, you know, 7 to 10 year average time for flashes, depending on her ethnicity. And she goes off when she's 60. What are the chances are that she's still going to be flashing?
Well, there are some studies that have actually, the Pan-Ovarian Asian study and a few others, that have shown that about, believe it or not, 30 to 40% of women still have bothersome hot flashes in their 60s. And I found this statistic, which I don't think people really know. It's 10 to 15% of women in their 70s are still bothered with bothersome hot flashes. So it's not some small number. 10 to 15% in their 70s and 30 to 40% of women in their 60s. Now, the older you are, many women can get by with much lower doses. And I'm sure you've seen this too, where we say, okay, let's see, we gradually reduce the dose and see how they're doing. And we'll get all the way down to say a 0.025 patch. And then they'll say, gee, I'm doing great, but I'm curious, go off. And then they're miserable and they go back on their 0.025. Yeah, exactly. So that's wonderful.
I know. All right, let's take another scenario. Let's say a woman is taking it not for hot flashes, but she has osteopenia, low bone mass, and her mom had osteoporosis and she's worried. So she wants to stay on it for bone health. She's now been on it 5-7 years. What would you tell her?
Well, I think first of all, early on, as you know, and I know most people, not all need the standard dose to stop that real rapid bone loss that happens. But as we get older, we get into what's called age-related bone loss. So these lower doses are actually quite effective in preventing further bone loss. So those are the women that I, over time, gradually would just reduce their dose to reduce any risk of their, you know, blood clots and strokes, and also transition them to a transdermal delivery at least around age 60. I would say for your bone health, you got to look at bone health over a lifetime. And one thing to remember is that when you stop estrogen for bone health, you do have just rapid bone loss again, okay? You're going to lose what you maintained for all of those years. So you better have a plan of action to go on something else. And some women will transition to another bone drug to maintain their bone mass, like a bisphosphonate or something else.
Or so, even something like Avista, raloxifene, right?
Well, yes. So for instance, raloxifene or Avista, which you've talked about, it's that selective, that CIRM drug. The good thing about it is it preserves and reduces, you know, bone loss. It can actually treat fractures of the spine, okay? But it also has a 50% reduction of breast cancer risk.
I know, people forget that.
The problem with it is that in early women, especially, it can cause hot flashes. And some have leg cramps with it too. But that is a great transition though.
Okay, but let's just say, for the sake of discussion, this woman says, you know, I like being on my estrogen. I don't want to switch. I want to make sure that I'm going to get bone protection. Would you keep her on for life?
Again? Yes. Okay. The short answer is
that's all I want, a short answer. Yes.
Yeah, with no contraindication. I think we are now, especially, there's no set reason for women to have to go off hormone therapy. Yeah. Okay. Right. And that is extended duration. You know, I think consensus opinion is if you are healthy and you've been on it, you have go in regularly, have your labs done, have your mammogram. I don't want to feed a tumor if it's there. Okay. Right. There's no reason for you to, you have to go off hormone therapy. Right. So for bone health, sure, stay on it. That's not.
But also I think what you just said was really important. You just kind of threw it out there that you don't want to feed the tumor. There's a big difference between something increasing the risk of breast cancer versus potentially causing an existing breast cancer to grow. And that's an important differentiation, because what you just said was you want to make sure she gets her mammogram, because if in fact she does have a breast cancer, you don't want to do anything that's going to facilitate growth, which is not the same as saying, I'm worried that her taking estrogen long-term is going to increase her risk of getting breast cancer.
I want to tell you, this past year, it was all over the news, actually. I want to just commend and comment on the paper of the year from the journal Menopause this year that just got an award. It was by a colleague of ours, CO, I wrote his name down because I don't know if it's a woman or man, actually, S-B-A-I-K. And it was a phenomenal study published where they looked at 10 million senior Medicare prescription. It's one of those drug where you look at women who are on a drug versus women not. And women, and you know, it made the news because the women who are on estrogen alone, because they had a hysterectomy, didn't need to be on estrogen, they actually had a 19% decrease in mortality. And these were women on extended duration menopausal estrogen alone. And the women on the E plus P, because they had a uterus and they needed to be, they basically had a balance that versus between a 10 and 19% increase in breast density and breast cancer. Okay. But again, then there was a wonderful editorial written by one of our colleagues, Joanne Manson, in the same journal. And then Menopause, our society, sent out a blast saying, hey, everybody, this is a time and where you can reevaluate women. look at the dose, look at the delivery system, use safer, you know, delivery systems as these women get 65, 70, yeah. maybe, and lower doses. Okay. Yeah. And so it's an individualized approach, but there's not a hard, fast rule for what age you have to stop.
Correct. But the other thing that was interesting about that particular study is we know from the WHI that women who did develop a breast cancer while taking hormone therapy had a 40% decrease in mortality, which is another one of those messages that really did not get out there, that they were less likely Absolutely. To die. But let's also be honest, that was a short-term study.
Right.
This was much longer term, which is what makes it so important. So yes. important. Okay, yeah. I'm going to give you one more scenario, and I know you're going to love this one. This is someone who her internist wants her to go off. She's been on it for 10 years, and she says, no, no, I want to keep taking it because I'm worried about dementia.
Well, you've had Pauline Mackey on here, and now she's talking, doing it all. No, I mean, there is absolutely no data to stay. I mean, you know, year, and I know our government is now, I mean, our colleagues last week were telling us about what a 35 or 30% reduction in dementia. That data is really not there. If you really look at the large RCTs, I mean, I think it was stuff years ago that people really were looking into, but there is no data to say that staying on hormone therapy is going to reduce your risk for dementia. Okay. I think that being honored for hot flashes might reduce your risk for dementia. I mean,
exactly. And cardiovascular disease, you know, it's not the estrogen that's the secret sauce there. It's the hot flashes that are causing the problem.
Right.
Get rid of the hot flashes.
No. And the data that was all over the news that everybody was, you know,
a few weeks ago. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it really is like super old observational data. Since then, there's been better randomized controlled trials, large populations of people, and it doesn't show a reduction. If anything, there are some studies that even show it may increase. So
particularly if it started when someone is older.
Absolutely. So, and that was why that was one of the things in the box warning, which, you know, I agree. I think starting over 65 on that combination of Premarin and Provera, there it was called the WHIM study, showed an increased risk of probable dementia. And that is true.
Right. Right. I knew what you were going to say, but it was so important to make that point because it is out there. It is out there. All right, next one. All right, so we have this patient who she's been on her hormone therapy for 10 years and she was only taking it for hot flashes and she's now 10 years out. And so she's decided to go off. So her manicurist tells her, you know, you got to taper. Otherwise, those flashes are going to come back. Her gynecologist says, no, 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 that's ridiculous. Just stop. What does Dr. Kagan say?
This is a data-free zone. There's absolutely no data to support either way. I can only say that most of clinical experience in my patients, they would like to try half dose first and see what they're like. I mean, like, you know, whether it be a patch or whether it's a pill, try to go down on the dose, see if they're miserable, having hot flashes, you know, they'll know their answer. But truth be known is they can just stop it. And within a week or two, I think they're going to know.
Yeah. And I think to me, I've always told people just stop it. But I do think that the advantage to going down is if someone tapers, that means that they might find what is the lowest amount of estrogen. Because like you said, as people get older, they might need a lot less.
Yeah, they need, as I said, yes. And frankly, I think that women psychologically feel better being on hormone therapy. I mean, maybe things are going to change now with the whole hype and the world going on everything. I think a lot of women still want to, even though we're not giving the message of the lowest dose or the shortest period of time, we're trying to give the appropriate dose, the appropriate delivery system for the appropriate time course that's good for that individual woman, right? Mm-hmm. And I keep saying woman here, and I feel like I should say there are people who don't identify as being a woman who have menopausal hot flashes and symptoms. So they're non-binary, okay? So we all this, but the clinical trials were all done.
Well, I think that's the point I make is when I, you know, want to be inclusive, of course, but we also have to appreciate the fact that the trials were done women.
Exactly. So when I say women, I apologize to anyone out there who doesn't identify as being a woman. So, but I will say that a lot of women do like tapering because then they find the level that works for them.
Yeah.
And what if I tell you, I have a number of women you know, I talked about this in one of the other podcasts with you, who are really doing well on this, like it was a 14 microgram patch called Menistar. These are like these 60 to 70 year olds that it's been shown to preserve bone mass, but these women and the study were the average age was 63. And there was Hofflisch data on that, believe it or not. You know, it's not the moderate to severe, but these are women who are older, who still weren't sleeping great. They didn't feel great, but they went on just that little bit, 14 micrograms. So now it's hard to get, it's expensive. So many people do, even though you can't officially cut, you know, you're not supposed to, but a lot of people will take either the 0.375 patch and cut it in half, or like a 0.05 patch and they'll be on a 0.025.
Okay, next scenario, which is not uncommon. This is a woman who increased her oral estradiol to 2 milligrams because she was having such severe flashes and that was the only way to get them under control. But she's still taking her original prometrium dose of 100 milligrams that she was given when she was only taking 1 milligram of estradiol. And what she wants to know is that enough to protect the lining of her uterus? I mean, she's not bleeding or anything. And at what point do you increase that? When do you worry about, you know, because you always talk about matching estrogen and progesterone.
Okay, everybody. And this is something that a lot of our colleagues don't even know, because I see women coming in all the time bleeding on the wrong amount of progesterone. Anything over standard dose, first of all, the scenario of a separate estradiol and a separate progesterone has never been studied. They've never had like baseline endometrial biopsies and biopsies at 52 weeks to say, okay? But, you know, we do know that the 1 milligram estradiol oral is equal to a 0.05 patch, is equal to a 0.625 of the Premarin or the conjugated estrogen, okay? And with that, the 100 milligram nightly micronized progesterone that is in peanut oil is the dose that goes along with that combined continuous regimen. And there is some data, okay, as far as biopsies and the combined Bijuva pill I told you about. And by the way, that progesterone is not in peanut oil, it's in palm oil. So that's one thing to keep in mind. So that's endometrial safety. Now, another thing you can do is do the cyclic regimen. We do have a little bit of data on that too. We had some data with 0.625 with 200 milligrams of micronized progesterone for 12 nights, and that's endometrial safety data. When women are going on 2 milligrams of estradiol, that's twice the amount, and it's twice the amount of a patch, like a 0.1 or a 0.07, you know, 0.75 patch, they really need to be on more progestogen. So we then tell them they need to go up to that 200, although there isn't really good data. And if they're bleeding, you have to evaluate that. I mean, that's all there is to it. There's just no data on it. So we do have data with synthetic progestins, you know, using like the 5 or 10 milligrams of medroxyprogesterone for 12 to 14 days. But most people don't want to use medroxyprogesterone these days.
Right. Right.
But that's, you know, when they're on the higher doses of estrogen, like that patient, I would say, get that IUD in.
There's that too. But I think the important point is you can't just keep going up on your estrogen and take the same old dose of progestogen and assume that your uterus is protected.
That is the point you're trying to make.
So this next one, I actually wrote a version of this, and then this came in from a Substack reader, which I thought was a better question. And her question is, I used estradiol gel for 8 years at the start of menopause. I decided to stop and stop for 3 years, but my hot flashes, sleep, mood were relentless and violent. So I decided to start again after my 3-year hiatus at the age of 65, and I feel so much better. Is this a problem, having stopped and then started again a few years later? And I'm going to add on to that question. And at what point, like when you talk about taking a little hiatus, there's a difference between 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, and 10 years. So can you talk about that a little? Because that comes up a fair amount.
A lot, it does. And I tell people we have no idea, but we do know, okay. Okay, on that lady, I would do a full risk assessment again. We got to look and see, you know, what's the big risk? Okay, the big risk is that you're giving estrogen to potentially coronary arteries that have plaque and you're going to rupture a plaque, okay? So you really want to look at you have to do a whole cardiac risk assessment.
But she's doing a gel. I'm just throwing that out there.
Yeah. So
it would be different if she was on oral, right?
Absolutely. First of all, it's a given. Okay. These women that come in greater than 10 years and over 60, that's another whole topic. Okay. Yeah. The data is minimal. I don't think it's an absolute contraindication. I also will say that woman might have had menopause at 58. So when she's 65, she's only like 5 or 6, 7 years, you know, postmenopausal. So she kind of falls in some window there. Transdermal is absolute. All right. So it's a gel or a transdermal patch. And the big risk is when you first initiate hormone estrogen, as far as blood clots are concerned.
Yeah.
Okay. But we don't know the status of her coronary arteries, as far as whether we're going to induce harm or not. And I think then they really need a full, you know, cardiac evaluation. I think you had a whole wonderful podcast with our colleague, Jim Simon, a two-part series.
Yeah, which I'll put that link in the notes as well, because we went through, we spent a whole hour.
It was wonderful. I am ordering, I have to tell you something, when somebody, 3 years doesn't bother me as much as, because that means she's had 3 years without any of, you know, estrogen.
And it's a gel.
Okay, it takes time to develop, you know, atheromas and atherosclerosis, and we know that can happen. And I look at other factors, of course. We do a risk score. She might need a coronary artery calcification, not a 3 years maybe, but I do think if someone comes in, they have never taken anything. They went through menopause. It would have been miserable ever since. They never were so afraid, and they're 10 years out and they're 61. I would do a full risk assessment, including a coronary artery calcification.
Yeah. Okay. And also I'll just throw in there, even though I have this disclaimer all over the place, you know, we're not giving medical advice. We're just talking. We're just giving education and information, and you still have to go to your own doctor and figure out what you should
do. I think there are risks. And I think
we don't know everything about these people who are writing in. So you got to go to your own doctor.
Exactly. It's true. And so I really think everybody really needs to, you know, just know that I just want to tell you again and again, the message for the FDA, you know, about removing these labels, rah, rah for the vagina. We've been trying forever. We were all there in 2015 at a real scientific presentation, right? A real scientific advisory board with real experts trying to do that. So that's, you know, a given. The message, the other box, you know, in a way, I'm very happy because I also think it's deterred a lot of women, and why the WHI, you know, using PremPro is not applicable to, say, lower doses transdermal and the micronized progesterone that we use these days. But we really do have to look at that this is not still a medication that is riskless, and we need to have some risks and warnings, and I would like to see what that's going to be. But the public media perception, based on all of the, you know, interviews and the news and social media about the reduction, how we've harmed women by not giving them hormone therapy, you know, they've caused divorces, and, you know, basically women are going to die if they don't go on hormone therapy, is not true. And it makes me sad, because I don't want all women to think, do you know how many women I see that are super healthy, that are in their 70s, that are, you know, yes, they're using local vaginal something. Okay, I want them using that for a good sex life and to control bladder function. But many of them are absolutely fine and healthy, and they do not need to be on hormone therapy.
Well, and that's the real message, is that it's an individual choice.
Absolutely.
All right, another one. This is kind of interesting. Woman who's had a hysterectomy, and she wrote in to say that, you know, she was taking or is taking a 1 milligram estradiol pill, and she's doing fine, but she's interested in switching to conjugated equine estrogen, Premarin, because she heard on one of my podcasts that that actually gives better breast protection. So she wants to know, number one, is that correct thinking? And number two, what is the equivalent dose? Because estradiol and conjugated estrogens, you know, they don't have the same kind of dosing. So people sometimes don't know how to make that kind of a switch.
Yeah. I mean, truthfully, we don't have that data. This data is like inference, you know, it comes from the fact that Premarin, conjugated estrogens, is made up of, you know, what is it, 20, 24, 25 different products.
Something like that, yeah.
And some people feel that some of those products are SERM-like, like they block the effect of estrogen on the breast. And we did see on the estrogen alone arm, and it wasn't stopped until 7 years, but that was because they crossed the risk for stroke risk. Okay, that was the line for increased risk for stroke. There was seemed to be a tendency or trend towards reduction in breast cancer risk. Okay, so there are those that do believe there's a very big difference between estradiol and conjugated estrogens. But again, we don't really have that data. We have some animal studies. We have breast, you know, under the microscope, you take breast biopsies and you look and, you know, so preclinical data, we say, okay?
Yeah. But let me just interrupt you for a second, because by that same token, we hear women say, well, estrogen decreases the risk of breast cancer. And the only data we have that actually proves that to be the case is from the WHI with conjugated equine estrogen. So you can't assume, a lot of people say, well, bioidentical is better. No, it's not better. It's different.
You can't assume that at all. And that's why I'm saying some of the preclinical studies and animal studies, and you're looking under the microscope at like breast blood and breast proliferation, and it's very different with conjugated estrogen than it is with estradiol. Okay, I will tell you that. That's that we know. But clinically, we really don't have the data except that business from the WHI. So, okay, fine. So let her go on Premarin. I love the drug. You know what else is one of the advantages of Premarin, which no one uses anymore, is it's longer acting. Do you know how many women need the estradiol itself?
Wait a minute. I didn't know that. Really?
You didn't? There are, yes, conjugated estrogen has a very long half-life.
Wow.
Very long. So many people who start flashing on estradiol, sometimes they have to cut their pill and take half a dose in the morning, half a dose at night. And women on conjugated estrogen, there is a longer half-life. So that's another one. Second one I want to say is the equivalence. I've always said 0.625 is like 1 milligram of estradiol. Yeah. Now, I know some people think that 1 milligram is like 0.45, but I don't know where that comes from.
Well, I've always said the same thing, and I don't know where that one comes from either. That's just what I've always done.
Frankly, and let me just say, people out there, people, you cannot measure levels. First of all, I'm not into measuring levels, but if you're going to measure a level, 0.625 is, you can't measure a level. You have no idea what you're getting. I mean, yes, it has some estradiol in it, but it's not going to help. So whereas the estradiol, yes, you can measure a level.
But by the same token, this switching products is really tricky. And another one came in from a woman who was using a 0.05 estradiol patch, but her skin's really irritated. So she decided that she wants to use either the spray or the gel instead. And how's she going to know what the equivalent dose is to her patch? I mean, they're all estradiol products.
You really need to look at the package.
But it's different.
You know what you have to do? You have to take out the package insert, and then you have to look at the, you know, bioavailability, the C average. You have to look at the C max. Like, you really have to look at the curves side by side, but there's no head-to-head trials. So who knows?
Come on. What woman's going to be able to figure that out for the moment, unless she happens to be a
scientist? Well, she doesn't, but the physician needs to decide what is an equivalent dose. Okay. And that's the thing. Well, I mean, if you really look at the gels, the little packets of gels, like the Divigels, you know, if you look at them side by side, they tend to be a little bit lower than, you know, even though they do have multiple doses that are supposed to be equivalent, when you actually look at them side by side, they seem to be a little bit lower.
So, not to mention, you can't always get all the stuff out of those little foil packets.
The spray, the
spray.
The
point is, it's not always so easy to know the equivalent dose. Sometimes it's going to take someone actually really doing the math.
Trial and error. I look and see what do they consider in their studies standard dose.
Yeah.
And in their standard dose, I try to start people on. And 1 milligram is standard dose.
Yeah. All right. This is one that came in just before we started taping in my Substack. She got in just under the wire. This is this woman's question. How can you tell the effectiveness of the hormone therapy you're taking other than no more hot flashes? I still feel a lack of motivation, low libido, joint aches, and I'm so much slower running. So what would you tell her?
You know, first of all, you know, are you sleeping? That's the first question that I ask. You know, it's one thing to treat your hot flashes. I'm curious to know about your sleep. All right. Hormone therapy is not an antidepressant. It's not going to give you more energy. It's not going to help you run better. It's not going to have any of those effects. I think there's a lot of misinformation. Yes, while you're going through the menopausal transition, many women describe arthralgias, aching. Okay. And yes, estrogen can help that. But I will tell you something, the data is not there at all for all the other musculoskeletal benefits or muscle that you keep hearing about on social media. So I try to do some education, and we do talk about, you know, what could also be going on, you know?
Yeah. I mean, the thing that struck me, honestly, with when I looked at her list of issues that she's concerned about is her lack of motivation. The lack of motivation, to me, really is a little bit of a red flag and the low libido, that there might be some other issues going on there that have nothing to do with her hormones, unless it's, as you mentioned, that she's not sleeping.
I mean, I think that she may have, we got to look at sleep, but then I also think she could have a low level of depression. And that is what's really happening here. So, and estrogen is not an antidepressant. Okay. Mm-hmm. I mean, and that is reality and people don't want to accept that, you know?
And so, I think also it's about being realistic about, I have a lecture that I give to women called What Estrogen Will Do, Won't Do, and Might Do, because everyone has this idea that it's like this magic pill that is going to make them feel like they're 25 again.
And well, you know, somehow I'm so happy that, you know, menopause is out of the closet. And I'm so happy that people are opening their minds up again to using menopausal hormone therapy in the right, safe way. But I don't want to go back to what was when I started my career, which was feminine forever. Robert Wilson, you have a great slide on that, you know, where people, you know, think that they're going to have a fountain of youth by taking hormone therapy, and it's going to cure everything in your life.
And I talk about that a couple of weeks ago in my episode about what happened if the FDA, and I kind of start off with, you know, what goes around comes around, because that's where we were before all of this.
We're old, Lauren.
We've been around long enough.
We have historical memory of the past. And you know, people have to set their expectations for what's realistic and what's safe. Let's talk about being safe.
And what's safe. Okay, another one. Woman's 51 years old. Her mom had osteoporosis. She's worried. She's taking her transdermal estrogen because she has low bone mass and she's worried about progressing. So she's doing all the right stuff. You know, she's doing her calcium. She's doing weight-bearing exercise. But her question is, look, the reason she's taking estrogen is that she wants to get maximum bone protection. So what is the minimum dose of estradiol that she needs to ensure that she is going to get maximum bone protection? Understanding that it may not prevent all progression, but she just wants to know, what does she need at a minimum?
Well, at her age, I would suggest standard dose hormone therapy, which I said before, there are studies showing the 0.05 patch, the 1 milligram, or the 0.65 of Premarin is what is felt to be standard dose for somebody at that age that will give her the best protection for her bone, okay? But I will say that with a caveat, because there are studies where lower doses have had approval for preventing bone loss, all right? So, you know, we have to see where she's at. You know, I have to look at her bone density. The best thing she could do is go on standard dose, because the reason I say that is because there's fracture data on standard dose, all right? Whereas we don't have fracture data at all on the lower doses. So, and at her age, she should be on a point standard dose. And then I would get a bone density 2 years from her previous bone density. And that's what I would say.
Okay. And then if that one is still showing stability in terms of
Just stay on that dose. Absolutely. Because we have fracture data on that.
Yeah. The other thing, as I recall, when you gave the lecture on this at the Menopause Society, and you had a slide, which I have,
I did.
Which goes through the different estrogen formulations and what dose of each you would recommend in terms of bone protection. And I can certainly put that in the program notes unless you want to have it at the top of your head and want to kind of run through that now.
Well, I did. I mean, I highlighted that the only data for fracture for women, even with osteoporosis, who are 52 and they're healthy and their diagnosis is based on a bone density of a minus 2.6, say, or something like that somewhere. Okay. Standard dose is really the dose, which is 0.05 patch, 1 milligram of oral, 0.625 of conjugated estrogen. And that's kind of the three that are being used these days. But low dose is half of that. An ultra low dose is like that 14 microgram patch. And those all do have, if you look at each individual product, there is some data on these low and ultra low preventing bone loss. Okay. But not necessarily in that woman who is, you know, what is she, 50, 52? That's why I would think that standard dose is the dose.
Yeah. And just to, I know you've said this before, but I think it's worth emphasizing before we close the bone topic, is when do women lose most bone?
Starts before the final menstrual period, you know, but it's really in the late perimenopause, over the transition into that first few 1 to 2 years post final menstrual period.
And then for women who are taking, and for women who are using birth control pills to manage their irregular periods and menopause symptoms and for contraception, are they also going to get bone protection?
They absolutely will be. That's another good reason to wait till 55, and then transition over.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, honestly, I think that is something that is so important to emphasize that we just don't talk enough about, that for the women who are reluctant to go on a birth control pill, who are low risk and not smokers, that boy, there's so many benefits.
I don't know why the social media people are pushing only, it's very challenging, and there's no reason to give people hormone therapy when they're having regular periods or when they're
It's also, I mean, it's not going to accomplish the things that you want to accomplish.
Exactly.
Something much better.
And frankly,
it's not as sexy, you know.
Well, it's a disservice. Remember, and I think you've done one on this, and where you're going to do one again on the benefits of hormonal contraception in reducing, you know, ovarian cancer risk, uterine cancer risk, you know, those breast cysts and tenderness and all the complaints that we hear. There really is no reason for people to be afraid.
Absolutely. Okay. There's always more questions. We could do this for hours, but
for hours.
You know, you have to get to the office. And I think we've covered a lot of ground. So is there anything like you're dying to say that we didn't cover?
Yeah. I have only one comment, which is do not suffer. In 2025, almost 2026, I can only tell you that every woman deserves treatment for hot flashes. And whether you're using hormone therapy, and there's not just one dose, there's not one delivery system, and there's not, you know, one way of giving it, okay? Or one of the alternatives, which we now have two newly, you know, approved neurokinin 3, and one is a 3-1 receptor antagonist that will effectively treat your hot flashes. You should, at a minimum, it's a crime not to be treated, really.
I agree, because when we look at the long-term issues that are very often attributed to not taking estrogen, I think we can really make the case that it's not about not taking estrogen. It's about people that have persistent moderate to severe hot flashes.
Absolutely.
And the damage that does. And our number one goal should be to get rid of those hot flashes instead of puffing it out.
Get rid of the hot flashes and sleep. And my other final comment is sleep, sleep, sleep. We need more sleep evaluation. And I think you and I heard that at our meeting this year.
Oh, yeah.
How many people may be on hormone therapy, but they're still not sleeping.
Right.
So we need more. There are board certified sleep specialists, and we need to figure out why that person's not sleeping. Not sleeping is really the root for so many of the problems that we see in women in midlife and beyond.
It's the root of all evil, right? Not sleeping, having hot flashes. If only were that simple. Okay. Thank you so much for spending this time.
It's so great. And you do such a great job. I want to say this over and over again. I'm so proud of my dear colleague and friend, Lauren Stryker, who is really does one of the best jobs at being evidence-based, personable, caring. And you really know how to interpret. I love when you say, I'm going to read the articles for you and I'm going to interpret it and share with everybody. So,
well, right back at you. And there's a reason why I think this makes you the most common repeat guest I have had.
You're so sweet.
Okay. Like Saturday Night Live. You know, I should get you a jacket or something. You've been on so many times.
All right. Take care. Enjoy.
Thank you. Right.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.